everybody. Welcome to Peck Report. I am your host, Josh Peck. So, turns out there's some more interesting stuff about Isaac Newton that I wanted to talk about. In a larger context, though, this idea of trying to develop a universal language, it's a pretty old pursuit. Newton even tried his hand at it. And, you know, that leads us to wonder, is this an attempt to get around the curse of Babel, Tower of Babel? Everybody's getting together and doing this thing that God really had a problem with. So he came down, split everybody all up, gave everybody different languages. Now we already have the ability to learn other languages if we put the time and effort into it. We can, you know, anybody can learn any language if you give it enough time, if you're motivated to do so. So is the idea of universal language, is that something that might show up prophetically? I mean, there have been attempts at this for a long time. And, you know, with prophetic things like having a one world religion, a one world government, doesn't it stand to reason that maybe something like that would be, something included with that would be, a one world language? Right now, it seems like English would be the best candidate for that. It's spoken all over the world. It's pretty utilitarian. There's different degrees that you can learn it and still communicate pretty effectively with people. I mean, even that sentence, you know, there are varying degrees that you can learn English and communicate effectively with people. I mean, you could say that same sentence and say, you could learn English good or bad and still talk either good or bad. You know, I mean, there are simple, like easier ways that you can say things, or you can make it more, complex. So it seems like English already has that, but, we'll have to get to this in a minute, but there's actually something called Pidgin English now, which is a really, really, it's like an infantile form of English. And, you know, that just makes me wonder, you know, if people can learn that, why not just learn English? But all that aside, Isaac Newton, I want to talk about Isaac Newton and his attempt at a universal language, which he ended up abandoning. Then I want to talk about this Pidgin English thing, and then I want to talk about some other examples throughout time of different attempts of trying to develop this universal language, even using music and using colors. One guy tried to develop this language that he said he received from a green alien or something. So we got to talk about all that. Now, some of this is going to be for members only, so if you haven't had a chance to already, make sure to go to dailyrenegade.com and become a member today. Now, there's very little known about Isaac Newton's studies at the time leading up to his entering Trinity College in Cambridge in 1661. You know, 100 years ago, Sir David Brewster wrote, quote, "We have not been able to discover the nature of the studies by which he was to be prepared for the university," end quote. More recently, Professor Andrade expressed the familiar view that Newton's being sent to Cambridge, quote, "was probably due to as much of the fact that he showed himself unlikely to make a good farmer as to his scholastic achievements," unquote. Another biographer wrote, quote, "the intellectual side of the boy had been thoroughly awakened during his last years at school, and his intense curiosity and consequential philosophical meditations concerning nature's expressions must have made severe inroads to the time on the time which should have been spent in marketing farm produce," end quote. So this is not only nature's but man's expressions upon which the young Isaac Newton was meditating at this time. Its purpose of we're going to look at a paper by, I believe it's by Eliot, which is on Newton's universal language. Now there's two reasons why the author here, Eliot, believed that, this manuscript to belong to the period just before or after Newton's entry into Trinity College in 1661. And he lays that out. I mean, just looking at the handwriting and everything, it seems like it was something earlier and something that he abandoned. Also, Professor H.W. Turnbull, in a personal letter, confirmed that the handwriting in the notebook is very early from Isaac Newton's life. Now, the present manuscript was sold by Messrs. Sotheby and Company in the sale of Portsmouth collection of Newton papers in 1936 to an American collector, the late Hiram J. Hall of New York City. And so the author of this paper is describing how he was able to obtain like photographs of the manuscript to be able to look at and examine. Now, the manuscript shows that Newton began his attempt at creating an artificial, like, universal language twice over. So the first attempt, which is called the draft, is both shorter and less elaborate than the second, which is called the scheme. The sections 1 of the letters and 4, some other conjunctions, do not figure in the draft at all, and in other sections, like 2, 5, and 6, the later version is both fuller and more subtle in its philosophical refinement. And there's no difference in the handwriting. The scheme may represent an immediate continuation and improvement of the initial draft, rather than a second attempt made after some lapse of time and perhaps inspired by someone else's work with which Newton had meanwhile become familiar. The most likely work to have influenced Newton was Delgarno's Ars Signorum in 1661, which he probably knew before beginning his first draft, and so the first alternative, just outline, seems to be justifiable and acceptable. So there's the earlier work, the draft, later work, the scheme. Now, the 17th century preoccupation with language planning, it's familiar to any student of that period. There are two principal reasons for it. First, the decline of the medieval Latin had deprived the world of scholarship of a handy medium of international communication. And secondly, there was a growing awareness of the inadequacy of the vernacular languages for scientific discourse. That made philosophers and scientists increasingly enamored of the idea of a universal character or an international symbolism capable of being understood by members of all speech communities. This plain style of scientific language or prose was not enough. You know, men dreamt of a linguistic tool that was not only internationally interpretable, but could also serve as an instrument of philosophical inquiry, scientific discovery as well. So there were frequent parallels that were drawn between such a universal character and mathematical symbols. Robert Boyle wrote in a letter to Samuel Hartlib in 1647 that he wrote, quote, "And truly, since our arithmetical characters are understood by all the nations of Europe the same way, though every several people express that comprehension with its own particular language, I conceive no impossibility that opposes the doing that in words that we see already done in numbers," end quote. So Seth Ward expressed the same thought when he wrote in 1654, quote, "An universal character might easily be made wherein all nations might communicate together just as they do in numbers and in species," end quote. Now, two principal possibilities were envisaged by the language planners of the 17th century. One, the creation of a universal character, properly so-called. That is a symbolism comparable to those of mathematics or musical notation to be read by different speakers in their own respective languages. The recent discovery that Chinese characters could be thus interpreted and read in widely differing dialects acted as further inspiration towards this cause. And two, the creation of an artificial language based on philosophical principles and capable of being spoken by anyone. Now, many and various were the attempts to realize either or both of these possibilities, from, you know, Bacon's sketchy outlines in The Advancement of Learning from 1605 to Wilkins' ambitious Essay Towards a Real Character in a Philosophical Language in 1668. on the continent, Descartes and Leibniz, beside a host of lesser men, joined in this quest for this linguistic utopia. So Newton tried his hand at this, and he begins with what's called the nature of things themselves, what he calls, suggesting as a start a classification of notions, which would form the skeleton of a lexicon, whose compilation was to be facilitated by various like tables of conjunctions, which from the name of anything imposes the name akin to it. So these tables recall Delgarno's lexicon Grammatico Philosophicum, and also as also does Newton's suggestion to mark each primary category with distinctive letters of instruments, with S, and then beasts with T, the soul's passions with B, so on and so forth. The chief modification, which Newton then proceeds to consider, which is expressed by alternate vowels and consonants, are listed here. So there's five of these. One, the degree to which an attribute may be ascribed to the given thing. These gradual vowels, diphthongs, are those following are prefixed to the root word. Two, the number of things involved. Three, the case or state of which thing is. Four, the time when which the given thing is or was in the specific state. Five, the quantity and number of times, or how long or how often the given thing is or was in its case. So from this, it became apparent that the more specific the meaning, the longer the word becomes. So additional letters have to be inserted to express moods, like whether the given thing is, in its case, necessarily, contingently, so on and so forth. So the alternating vowels and consonants are meant to aid the pronouncing of Newton's artificial words. And it's in that context that we're reminded of Newton's preparatory researches into the sounds of speech and of phonetic pages of his 1661 notebook. Now, he began his project for a universal language, as did Delgarno and later Wilkins, with he began it just like in a similar way. Now, in the notebook, this phonetic system was drafted together with two attempts at creating the shorthand alphabet, and that might have been intended as like an embryonic universal character. But at the same time, Newton was closely envisaging a classification of notation, or notions, excuse me, as a basis for his philosophical language. So this he began to work out in the classified word list in the notebook in various general heads, as it's called, alphabetically arranged. So the list begins with artis, and extends as far as of minerals, followed by further columns marked out but left blank. Now, there's a lot of gaps in Newton's scheme. He doesn't give us a list of the root words without which the whole scheme remains unusable. So only a few random examples are given. So tor, T-O-R, signifying a thing that is hot or cold or warm. Tol, T-O-L, signifying a painter. Ben, B-E-N, meaning man. Bach, B-A-K, meaning father. So that's about all we get. Now, apparently, he never finished this. He planned this universal language. He was interested in it, but he never actually finished it. But people have been working on this type of thing for a while, and the reason's not exactly known why he didn't finish it. It's either he just became uninterested with it, or maybe he got to a point where he thought that it wasn't a good or worthwhile pursuit. That maybe it was even wrong in some way to create this kind of language, and maybe. But that goes back to, the Babylon stuff. I mean, it could be, we know Isaac Newton was heavy into Bible stuff, so he would have been familiar with the story of Babel. Maybe he decided that He shouldn't try to create a universal language because it's, in a sense, undoing God's decision at Babel. So in modern times, there's attempts at this. The one that pretty much immediately comes to mind, and if you haven't heard about this, you'll probably laugh because it's kind of ridiculous. Because it's one of those things. It's like, well, why don't you just learn English then? Just teach people English because it's not that far off. People are capable of learning English. You know, this idea that English is like the most complicated language in the world. I don't know that I actually buy that. it's one of those things that people say, but they can never cite a source for. I've heard a lot of people say that. I've never heard anybody say where they got that from, except that they heard it from somewhere else. But when you think about English, you know, we don't have like gender in words, like male and female words, like the way that, you know, a lot of other languages do. It's really utilitarian, and you can have a very basic version of English. Just listen to President Trump talk, for example. You have a very basic version of it that pretty much everybody can understand, and it does. But you can also get more complicated and you know, more involved with it. So, you know, just basic English, which is pretty much just American, you know, the American language, basic English. It's not. I don't think it's as difficult as people want to think. But there are some people who think that, and they think for some reason that people in other, say, more primitive cultures aren't capable of learning regular English. I don't know why people think that. I think anybody can learn any language if they're motivated to do so. So this thing called Pidgin English was developed, which is it's basically a bastardization of the English language is what it is. So there's an article on Omniglot.com that talks about the origins of Pidgin. It says the mongrel language of the world in a patchwork tongue of trade, migration, empires, and historical movement. Pidgin English, in its varying forms, is a lingua franca, a simplified bridge language evolving through necessity. I don't know how necessary it is, because we do have English that people can learn. After extended contact between groups without a single common language. So for example, like in Papua New Guinea, there's something like 800 tribes that can't communicate with each other. But again, and the idea is, you know, they need Pidgin English so they can stop fighting. And I don't think it has as much to do with them not being able to communicate as just the primitive nature of their culture. You know, and doesn't mean that they're valued less as human beings or anything like that. But these are the types of tribes. If you've ever heard of cargo cults, I wrote a little bit about cargo cults in, I believe, Cherubim Chariots. There's these cultures that, like during World War II, you know, planes would land and drop off supplies to these primitive cultures and leave. And then when the planes left, the people would build planes, sort of, but they would take a bunch of sticks and twigs and stuff and, like, form the shape of planes, and then they would, like, sit in these things and worship these things and wait for the planes to come back. It's the primitiveness of their culture that is, you know, that's why all the infighting and all that stuff happened. It's not because of a common language. Again, you know, when I say primitive, I don't mean that in an insulting way. It is what it is. It doesn't speak at all to their value as human beings, just to the culture that they belong to. So they say in the article that Pidgin English was developed out of necessity. I personally don't buy it, because you could just teach them English, or any other language, really. It doesn't even have to be English. English is probably the easiest, most utilitary for somebody in that culture to be able to learn. But anyway, so it goes on. It says, formed from numerous languages and influences, Pidgin is a wide term covering a range of regional hybrids which evolved through historical events such as the spread of empire, settlements, migration, and international trade. Found in Africa, Indonesia, parts of Asia and Caribbean, English-derived pidgins are inventive, innovative, and often quite literal. For example, in Tok Pisin, the grass belong het, or grass belong head, simply means hair. See, and this is what's weird about this, because when you listen to this, like, go online and search it's P-I-D-G-I-N, pidgin English, and listen to how they talk. They sound like 3-year-olds. You could teach them the word hair, or you could teach them grass belong het. It says in the article, taking more of a baby speak approach, pidgins can seem to imitate toddler speech or phrasing, having no tones, simple vowels, etc., and in effect are used for the same purpose, to get what you want quickly, using whatever communication in terms of reference you can. A few well-placed words and gestures were all that was originally needed, and the language evolved from there. But again, you already have that in English. You already have, like, English already has a simplified version to it. So I don't know. I think these kinds of attempts actually end up devaluing other cultures, like as if they couldn't possibly learn such a difficult language like English. So we have to make them this dumbed down version that they'll be able to understand. I don't know. To me, that seems insulting to them, to think that they can't learn even just basic English. So it says, because of their spontaneous adaptability, pidgins are unlike other languages in that they can be as structured or as unstructured as needed. There are no strict rules as such. Pidgins are also not used as mother tongues, though over time and generations the language evolves. It's adopted and changes to gradually become a first language for new generations. Now think about this, with a dumbed down version of English like that, how could you really advance a culture? You know, get a culture out of like primitive warlike fighting. How could you actually advance it? Like for example, how would you write a medical textbook in pidgin English? You know, how would you draw plans for to build a car or something like that? You can't really get into like nuance or deep thought. I mean, this essentially is consigning them to remain primitive. It says, historically, this occurs in situations where native language is seen as subordinate or banned in the case of slavery, and is the point where pidgin arguably moves to become a Creole or a stable nativized language. Scholarly debate remains, however, as to what point a pidgin language can evolve to become a Creole and replace a native language over the generations. Complicated stuff for such a seemingly simple language set. But it says, as an idea of how language evolves from no common language between English and native groups to pidgin languages to Creole, the tongue follows four main states of development. So there's restricted, and it says this is the beginnings of pidgin, used as a fundamental necessity when contact between language groups, English and native, is limited. Extended, if contact is more prolonged, pidgin develops and may be situationally encouraged to be used between natives themselves, as well as between other language groups. Creole, if pidgin survives and if internative use evolves enough, it can develop into a Creole language to become a next generation mother tongue in place of the native language. And standardization or decreolization, increasingly standardized and structured over time, the Creole becomes more rigid, developing into a standard stabilized language and very different from the original loose pidgin structures. So see, you teach, let's say you teach 800 Papua New Guinea tribes pidgin. Now they're all going to develop their own versions of it, because it even says here, very different from the original loose pidgin structure. So they still can't communicate anyway. Whereas if you just take English, for example, or again, it could be any language. It could be Spanish or French or anything. But if you want something that you have, something basic and easy, you know, may as well do English. You teach them all that, then they'll be operating on the same rules. You know, they'll be operating within the same framework, and then maybe they can communicate. It says Pidgin English today, adaptable and tenacious nowadays. Pidgin English is still in extensive use and is well recognized around the globe, especially in parts of West Africa and Oceania. In 2012, for example, the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations, Prince Charles visited Papua New Guinea, introducing himself as, and this is not a joke, he actually said this, Prince Charles, a prince, said, "Number one bikini belong Mrs. Queen," or "number one child belonging to Mrs. Queen." Instead of saying that he's the prince, the son of the queen, "number one child belonging to Mrs. Queen." That's what Pidgin English is. And the article says it proves the resilience and longevity which Pidgin, despite its modern roots, can have. If royalty can speak it, that's pretty high praise. I don't think so. I think it goes the other way around. I think it's embarrassing for a prince to be speaking like that. And I think that it's degrading to people of other cultures to suggest that they cannot learn basic English and they need this toddler kind of talk. That's just how I see it. I mean, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but anyway. So, you know, there's even modern attempts to instill or start a universal language for everybody. And if you think about it, when you look at prophecy, like we talked about before, one world government, one world religion, there's going to have to be some way for people to communicate. Not everybody is going to learn every single language. Now, that could come through technology. There's technology being developed today where you can literally speak into your phone and it will translate it to people, somebody else of any language of your choosing. And you can have a conversation that way. So that might happen. You know, there's several other ways. So this could be one of them if somebody does develop an actual universal language. There are some examples that I want to look at, some attempts to create an ideal universal language throughout time that we can look at. And is it possible that these were attempts? Like let's say that the enemy knows that he needs a universal language in order to fulfill everything he wants to do with the Antichrist. Yet the enemy doesn't know when his time is coming. So is it possible that all throughout time he's been trying to develop a universal language in the event that generation might be the last one? It's possible. So we're going to look at some attempts. Some of these have weird origins. Like I said, there's one of these where it's claimed by the person that developed it that he got the knowledge from a mysterious, like, green alien that was projecting thoughts into his head or something like that. So we got to talk about all that, but we're going to save that for members. So if you're not a member already, go to dailyrenegade.com and become a member, or you can click on the link in the description below. You get full Peck reports. You get full episodes of every show that we do. We have something like a dozen original shows. We're also building The Vault right now, which is a collection, a repository of videos from some of your favorite researchers, authors, video makers in the fringe Christian realm that will be in there that don't necessarily have original shows with us, but are backing up their videos in case YouTube ever deletes them. Also, that gives you one place that you can go and find all your favorite things. So we're building that. A membership is only $10 a month or $100 a year. I suggest getting the $100 a year because you get 2 months for free, plus you only got to pay for it once and you don't have to think about it for a whole other year. So it's a pretty good deal. Go and do that. We're going to call it quits for free viewers, for people who are viewing on YouTube and Facebook. Thank you so much. Make sure you subscribe. Click the bell for notifications. Also, if you're a chronic pain sufferer, if you want some CBD, some really good CBD or Kratom, the best available, actually, you can click on the links in the description below or go to dailyrenegade.com. There's also a link to a movie there, The Chosen, and you should check that out. It's really good. It's right at the top. Click that. Check it out. But all right, so we're going to move to members-only content. Thank you, everybody else. Don't forget to subscribe. Thanks, everybody. And yeah, till next time. I'd love to know what you think. Leave me a comment in the comment section below. Take care. God bless. Okay, everybody. So thank you for your membership, members only. This is members only content. Thank you for your membership and for being a part of the team, being part of the Daily Renegade family. So, like we said, there's been a lot of attempts throughout history to develop a universal language. Yeah, we're going to look at a few. The most famous is Esperanto. That's the most famous example. But we can look at some others because that one is pretty, for anybody who's interested in this topic, that one you're probably already familiar with. I think like George Soros's father or something is like obsessed with Esperanto. But that's the most like recognized attempt. That's the most famous example. But here's a few others. So there's Volapük, German Catholic priest Johann Schleyer. On a sleepless night in 1879, he felt a divine presence telling him to create a universal language. Isn't it weird that there's something in our psyche, there's something in our human psyche that has this compulsion to design a new language. Kids do it all the time. I remember when I was a kid, I thought like one of the coolest things to do would be to develop a whole new language. And a lot of kids actually do that. And you probably have too. I mean, to a certain extent, we all have. Isn't it weird that that's like deep in our psyche? It's like we have this longing to go back to the times before the curse of Babel, where we could all communicate with one another. Really, really strange. But anyway, he felt, apparently, from what he describes, a divine presence telling him to create a universal language. And designed to be easy to learn, it featured a simple system of roots derived from European languages, so simplified as to be unrecognizable from their origins. So Volapük spread through the middle class rapidly, and it was seen as a useful international tool of communication in a period before American economic domination sealed the status of English as the language of Europe. The movement's popularity faltered with Schleyer's insistence on umlauts. He said, quote, "A language without umlauts sounds monotonous, harsh, and boring," end quote. So that made language seem excessively foreign to many, particularly in the United States. He bitterly resisted any attempt to reform the language, and he eventually formed his own splinter movement. So Volapük then rapidly disintegrated into rival variants, which again, I mean, like what we just talked about with Pidgin English, it's the same thing happening there. All of which fell into benighted obscurity with the rise of Esperanto. So up until about the 1960s, the phrase to speak Volapük was a French idiom meaning to talk nonsense or gibberish, or like to babble. Though the expression had fallen into disuse until Nicolas Sarkozy used it in 2010 while complaining about UN climate summit negotiations temporarily confusing his interpreters. Bliss symbols. This was developed by Charles K. Bliss. This communication system was designed as a universal written language that everyone in the world could use, regardless of their mother tongue. So while working as a photographer and filmmaker in Shanghai during World War II, Bliss became fascinated by Chinese characters, their history, the notion that speakers of different languages could share a single written system. So, you know, what we looked at before with Newton, it was the same kind of motivation. He decided to develop a more scientific version of this idea as Bliss symbols, which combined elements from mathematics, molecular formulas, and electrical pictorials. Some of the symbols were pictographic, representing physical objects like a house or the sun, while other symbols were ideographic, representing ideas like the mind or the act of giving. So those symbols were designed to be easy to draw and combined to form complex concepts that would allow people of different languages and cultures to communicate effectively. So it had a base of 10 simple icons. The symbols could then be combined to create complex meanings. The end goal was to create a means by which humans could communicate without misunderstandings, which Bliss believed was the root cause of much of the world's suffering. Now, Bliss symbolics never caught on as an international communication tool, but they were used in the 70s, 1970s, to help individuals with cerebral palsy communicate. In the mid-1980s, 12-year-old Rachel Zimmerman developed a Bliss symbolic printer that allowed non-speaking patients to communicate effectively through a computer screen. This system is still used by thousands of physically disabled individuals today. Let's see, where do we want to go next? There was one called, let's get to that. Oh, here, this one's interesting. It was called Salrasol. So in the early 19th century, the musician Jean-François Soudre developed a method of associating letters of the alphabet with musical notes, allowing him to ask his students questions by playing his violin, which they responded to on piano. So Soudre thought that the technique, later known as telephony, could be used as a form of long-range stenography, but the Ministry of War saw it as a potential night telegraph. Now, despite successfully relaying messages such as, you will destroy the bridge at dawn, through a bugle, the military concluded that it was of limited use. So, after repeated failed attempts to convince the army and navy, Soudre turned instead to using the language as a way to help the blind and deaf to communicate. Soudre abandoned telephony in 1829 in favor of a new system, the musical language Sol-Rassol, which had seven phonemes based on the Western musical scale, do, re, mi, fa, so, la, si, and the latter known as T in English. Combinations of musical notes would be combined to form words, meaning that sol-re-sol could be communicated through speaking, singing, humming, or playing a musical instrument. Soudre even developed ways to express the language through the Roy G. Biv color spectrum. He did it with hand signals and even numbered tapping. The language had a deliberately limited range of possible vocabulary by including combinations of only four phonemes and allowing for 2,660 different words, which might sound like a lot, but that's not a lot, which was much less than natural languages and also featured a reasonably simple grammar that allowed words of reversible meaning. So, missile or good is reversed to salmi or bad, as just one example. Despite producing sol-re-sol dictionaries in multiple languages and giving popular demonstration before royalty and curious crowds, Soudre's death saw the slow decline of the musical language, though it's been revived online in recent years. AUI, this is the weird one. This is one of the most bizarre constructed languages. It's called AUI, lowercase a, capital U, capital I, and it translates as space spirit sound. It was developed by Austria-born Iowa psychologist John W. Weilgart, who allegedly claimed to have learned it as a child from a green alien humanoid who said that AUI was the universal language of logic used throughout the cosmos. So, unlike other attempts to create a universal language, AUI is unrelated to any existing human language and it makes no attempt at naturalism. Weilgart wished to create a language that allowed for free expression of ideas while remaining deeply wedded to inherent meaning in order to safeguard against the manipulation of meaning and the use of metaphor to confuse understanding and communication. He determined what he believed were the 31 fundamental universal elements of meaning and associated each with a vowel or a consonant. So P means before, is combined with O, meaning feeling, creating the word concept PO, or anticipation, before feeling, anticipation. Another example is the lowercase f means this, and that combines with the lowercase u, meaning human, to create foo, or this human, in other words, me. Combining b, meaning together, with u, creates boo, or together human, meaning you. So all words in AUI are similarly innately tied with their root meanings, which Weilgart believed would reduce prejudice and misunderstanding somehow. Weilgart believed in the universal applicability of his language. The language of space is the cosmic communication whose elements can be learned in an hour, apparently. It's the primeval language of the logos, of pure reason that takes our human race back to before the confusion of tongues at the Tower of Babel. Isn't that interesting? And that's a direct quote from Walgar. That whole thing that I just said, that was a direct quote from him. He actually said, quote, "It is the primeval language of the logos of pure reason that takes our human race back before the confusion of tongues at the Tower of Babel." End quote. So see, there we go. Now, while fascinating, this language has, little modern following, being extremely counterintuitive to human linguistic standards. So we'll have to wait till the Zeta Reticulans arrive to send native speaking instructors and audiobooks and stuff before we'll see that developed. So that's probably the weirdest one. But again, it goes back to this idea of before Babel, you know, we could all speak one language and now we can't. It's a curse. It's a curse that, you know, we tend to think will be undone when Jesus returns or when we die, you know, in the afterlife. We tend to think that. Seems like that would be the case. But, and that's really the only way to undo a curse, just like the curse of death. You know, there's a curse of death, and transhumanists are trying to reverse that today, but it's not going to happen. So I don't think that I think that there's going to be, like, attempts at universal languages, and I think that probably technology is going to play a big part in that. I don't think that there's going to be a time before the return of Jesus where everybody is literally going to speak the same language. You know, they might develop a brain chip that you can put in your head so you can hear, you know, if somebody speaks Spanish, you can hear it in English, you know, but they're still speaking Spanish, you're still speaking English, there's still different languages. I don't think that actual curse is going to be undone until the return of Jesus. But, you know, I'd like to know what you think. Go ahead, leave me a comment. And yeah, it's an interesting topic. And I wonder how this idea of universal language will play a role in the end times. And maybe that's why Isaac Newton abandoned it. You know, because we know later on in life, he, just like we saw before, we said in the last video that you know, he had this whole prophecy of 2060, and that came later on in his life when he developed that. So, interesting to think about. I'd be curious to know what you think. Leave me a comment, and thank you for being a member. Till next time, take care and God bless.